13th, but not Friday. Tuesday the 13th of November, 1979. We've been studying in the book of Exodus. And we got down to and through verse 8 in chapter 2. Exodus 2. Verse 8. We came to a rather exciting point here and stopped off, as many a continuous story does. If I were to hold you sort of in suspense. But Pharaoh's daughter had discovered little Moses in the ark in the bulrushes, and Sister Miriam was nearby and suggested that she could get a nurse for the child. And so in verse 7, it says, then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to thee a nurse, the Hebrew woman, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called for the child's mother. Of course, she's going to get to take care of her own baby boy. And what mother wouldn't want to do that? And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take the child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. Don't have her to be a nurse and take care of it. Now, I don't know how often that Pharaoh's daughter is going to visit the child, or if any, or anything of the kind, but she had been moved by its tears, and evidently she had practically fall in love with a child. So I imagine that she had quite a bit of contact with Moses when he was a little boy. And the child grew. And she, that is the mother, brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter. And he became her son. And she called his name Moses. And she said, because I drew him out of the water. Moses could be, I suppose, my son. There's been different opinions, even so much as to getting him out of the water. So I'm not an authority on what the word Moses does mean. Whether the word Moses means drawing out of the water or something else, I don't know. Well, we jump a few years. When it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burden, and he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew one of his brethren. Well, now there's quite a bit there that Moses was grown. We find that he had grown into all the wisdom of Egypt, but not yet, as the note says, of God. No doubt he had learned about the God of his fathers from his mother, as she nursed him as a nurse, brought up that way, and knew that these Israelites were his brethren. He no doubt knew that. But he hadn't received any instruction from God himself yet, which he was to receive later on. And that is what this was looking forward to. And it seemed he wanted to go out and see what his brethren were like, and he went out one day where they were working on all of the people and so on. And it suggests that he looked on them with sympathy when he saw their condition they were in, slaves. And it says that he went out into his brethren, looked on their burden, came to his heart, it seems, is the idea here. He wanted to see what they were like, what they were doing, so on. And here he finds an Egyptian smiting the Hebrew. Now, smiting there has the idea that he was using him pretty rough. Maybe in the end of death. And he looked this way and that way. And when he thought there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So this is his first act here. Now, we have some notes about this, and we could get some other references on it. For instance, there were no man to help. There are references in Isaiah 59 and 63. And the context there in which they're using these very words in those contexts. In one of them, it's, there was no man there to help. And probably that is what the idea is here, as we have in the note. Now, your first reading on that would be that he would look this way away and that way, and he saw that there was no man to see what he was doing. But that isn't just the idea. And he saw that there wasn't anybody to help. Why, he went to the rescue himself. And he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Well, is this thing all unknown? Verse 13. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews stole together. And he said to them, that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thy fellow? What you doing this for? Now, he's going to get a little bossy, is he? Well, being brought up in the king's court, a son of a princess, he probably is used to shoving inferior folks around. And so he felt that he had a right to ask this fellow and say, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? That is, thy fellow is one of your own kind, one of your partners. And he said, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Where'd he get all of that anyhow? Intendest thou to kill me and as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Well, remember when Joseph had his dreams, the question was asked, well, will this fellow rule over us? When the Lord came, the question was, well, we have this fellow rule over us. And Moses is running into about the same thing. He thought, you know, these people would know him. Now, you see, we can tell from this context here that Moses knew what he was to do. And he was going to do it right now. That's where we fall down, isn't it? Moses is going to do it in his own way. In his own time. He hasn't waited for instructions. And so he does something here and he gets caught. There's no one. Now, when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. Now, Moses is daughter's adopted son. I don't know how rash this king was, but evidently he's going to take things in hand. I don't know just how important Moses would be, even as a son or a daughter. I wonder if he would be as quick to kill, say, a pet as she had, a pet crocodile or a dog or whatever. You know, it just kind of looks almost out of reason to start out at first. But those kings back in those days, you know, were absolute monarchs. They had the power of life and death. And so, the king hears about it. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by the well. Not a well, but the well. The well that belonged to Jethro. Now, the land of Midian, he would have to go across either the wall of Shur, or he'd have to cross the Red Sea in some way to get across into the Arabian Peninsula where Midian was. That'd be a pretty good way from Egypt. So Moses was scared, and he fled. Now, in Hebrews 11:27, it says he didn't fear, and by faith he went into the wilderness. Does that kind of upset this or not? No, it refers to on ahead, way on ahead to chapter 10. When Pharaoh told him to get out, never wanted to see him again. Moses says, that's right, you won't. And then told him what was going to happen. That time Moses went out by faith. And not here. So don't get these two incidents mixed up, as so many do. Now the priest of Midian, that's what this fellow was, a priest of Midian, had seven daughters. And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Must have been a little like Laban was. Had two daughters which took care of his flocks, Rachel and Leah. And, well, if they had a bunch of livestock, I can give you quite a job to water them. I just used to wonder sometimes when I had to pump water for the horses. They could sure drink a lot, and the pump was slow, and it just took forever to pump enough water. And here these girls have to let those pitchers down into a well and them fall over and fill up and then draw them out and pour the water into a trough. And that wasn't easy work. And the shepherds, or others who used the well too, they came and drove them away. Drove who away? Drive the seven sisters away, or drive the flock away? I don't know. Probably the whole thing. Just shoved them out. Moses stood up and helped them. Watered their flock. Looks like he's going to maybe get himself in trouble again here if he was doing things like that. Moses kind of jumps in and does things. Well, he helped them. And they went home. And when they came to rule their father, he said, now, rule is also Raguel and Jethro. You'll find the word Jethro in down not many verses from this. He has three different names, as many people in those times seem to have. And he says to the girls, oh, how is it that you come so soon today? You got your work done in a hurry and got home. And they said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock. And he said unto his daughters, and where is he? Why is it that you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. Why did you go off to leave him like that and invite him in to have a meal with us? Call him to do something like that. Seven of them, one of them certainly would have thought of doing something like that for the poor fellow. But I guess they didn't. And Moses was content to dwell with the man. Made a home there. Well pleased, content. And he gave Moses it for his daughter. And she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. Now, in subsequent readings and so on here, leads us to believe that Moses went quite a number of years here before marrying this daughter of Reuel or Raguel or Jethro. Because from the time he went into Midian until the time that he took the people out of Egypt was 40 years. And about that time, it seems that Gershom was only a little boy. All right, you can see that as we go on. And she bare him a son, he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. And it came to pass, in process of time, that the king of Egypt died. The one that was going to get him. He died. And no doubt all of the others in the court and so on, high up, died too. So wasn't anybody left that remembered Moses. And the children of Israel sighed, rather a tame word in our language today, by reason of the bondage. And they cried. And their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And it didn't come up to God because of the bondage. They cried because of the bondage, and the cry came up to God. All our languages don't have their words in the same order in the sentences, and if they aren't revised and rearranged, why sometimes they come up with a funny meaning. And God heard their groaning, and he decides to do something. But did he decide to do this because of their sighing, and their crying, and their groaning? And because had been a faithful people and all that sort of thing? No. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Israel. No, it's Jacob. He made the covenant with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel and had respect unto them. He had notice of them. Saw what they were doing. Well, in these few verses here, you have the word God several times. You have several ands. Polysyndeton is the figure of many ands. It's rather interesting to read it through and look at those things. Chapter 3. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the backside of the desert, and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. Even to Horeb. That term is never used in the New Testament. Notice in your notes here, it says the first mention of Sinai, Horeb, is in connection with feeding of flocks, and so on. And, well, that might be. But he's way out there, way out alone. There's a wilderness, but still there was enough grass, and small shrubs, and so on, that you could feed flocks. Probably had to cover quite a little bit of territory. You didn't feed a flock on an acre or two of ground, but they had to cover quite a bit of territory. Some places the grass is so scarce in our own country, in some places it takes about 6 acres to keep one cow going. And if you had 1,000 cows, or you can figure it out how many acres it takes. recently had some visitors from Australia. They have a spread down there in the interior, and several thousand acres of land for the flocks that they have, herds. And from the pictures we see of it and so on, it probably looks about like it does in Palestine, maybe down at that time down in the Sinaitic Peninsula, around Mount Horeb. Oh, there were some saplings growing up, you know, maybe 10, 15 feet tall, rather thin, and the blades of grass are scarce on the ground. It just looks kind of desolate. So that was the kind of a country that Moses was feeding the flocks. And no doubt by his taking the flocks to some distance, it says here, he probably had to range out after some of the pastures were depleted and had to go farther and farther with them. And so didn't bring the flocks home every night, no doubt, but had to take care of them out in the wilderness. Well, when we read the story of Jacob, we find the same with him, that he had spent many a night out in the frost and in the cold, watching the flocks out in the desert. Well, verse 2, "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush." Out of a bush. We have fire mentioned so often in the Bible, and with about two main meanings or usages. Fire was used to destroy, and fire was used to purify. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. It kept burning and burning and burning, and not a branch dropped off, not a leaf dropped off. Wasn't consumed. Now, if you or I saw something like that, we'd be greatly surprised even in this age, wouldn't we? That'd be quite a sight. But all of the fire I've ever seen out like that, it was burning things up. But here, the bush just burned and burned and was still there. And Moses said, "I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt." Having been learned in all of science and all of that sort of thing of Egypt and so on, this was a strange sight to him. He probably never heard of a bush being capable of burning and still not being consumed. So this was a new one on Moses, who was an educated man, scientist of his day. It didn't make most anybody stop and look. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here am I." And he said, "Draw not nigh hither." Don't get too close to the bush. I don't know whether it burned him or not. I'm warning him not to get too close. "Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground." Well, we talk about Palestine being a holy land, but is the Sinaitic Peninsula a holy land too? Well, what makes it holy? Why was this ground holy here? It was holy because of the presence of God. That's the reason. Where God is holy ground. Is Palestine a holy land today? Is God there? Is he with his people and working with his people there and carrying out his covenant with them and so on? Is he doing that, or are they working on their own? Well, if they're working just on their own and so on, you can't call that a holy land. And one man who was a Jew told me he thought it was about the most unholy land in the world, and he's been there. sometimes we use terms without thinking. Mr. Welch has said that when you approach the 17th chapter of John, which is the real Lord's Prayer, that you take off your shoes. That's holy ground. Well, that's well said. That is one chapter in the Bible that one should go to with reverence and understanding. Take it slowly and see what it says and what it means. But it's the Lord's Prayer for his own. And some phrases in there lead us to believe it includes us even today. And so, possibly it is a good chapter for us to study. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And the Lord one time himself said that his father, God, was the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in Matthew. The Lord was speaking those words to prove resurrection. Of course, that isn't particularly in this context we're reading here in Exodus. For the Lord said that his father was the God of the living, not of the dead, and counted Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as really living, although they were dead. So resurrection was that certain, that he could call them the living. God speaks of things that are not as if they are. That's certain. Now, we're not that certain about things, are we? That's the reason why we borrow money. We have to have collateral or something like that. People don't take our word for it. Banks are wise to people. And so they have to have a collateral of some kind if we're going to give them a loan. And other things like that. And here, God introduces himself to Moses and said, I am. And that is emphatic. I am, the great I am. From which we get the word Jehovah. The God of thy father, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face. For he was afraid, he was scared to look upon God. Although God was showing himself here as an angel of the Lord. Wasn't really God himself, for no man has ever seen God, John tells us in his gospel. And the Lord said, Jehovah said, in your notes, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. And I heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land into a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Well, now here's quite a little bit in this paragraph here. The Lord tells quite a little bit. These two paragraphs. Now, firstly, the Lord says to Moses, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. When he says, I have surely seen, he means that he's really taken notice. And then he says, I've heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. For I know their sorrows. Well, now there is something that is comforting too. God knew their sorrows, and he knows ours. And when we cry, he hears. When we're afflicted, he knows it. He sees it. And then Jehovah tells him, and I am come down to deliver them. That's good news, isn't it? To rescue them out of the hand of the Egyptians. He thinks they've had enough of it. And to bring them up out of that land to a good land. And a large land. The word land is left out, that's understood. Unto a land flowing with milk and honey. My, wouldn't that be a sticky place to go around, cross over a brook, and be flowing with milk and honey? Have to wade through it? Or does it mean that? Or is this just a figurative expression? Now, we've never heard of the land of Palestine ever flowing with milk and honey. If it's flowing in the streams and so on, where did milk come from? Now, honey might ooze out of some of the rocks, cracks in the rocks, where the bees at that time quite often stored their honey because they didn't have hives and didn't have hollow trees, particularly in the wilderness. It's a figure of speech. Flowing with milk and honey means that it's a wonderful land, that it would produce all that they would need to eat. That's what it is. And of course, after all, eating is one of our prime concerns, isn't it? And he even tells them where. Unto the place of the Canaanites, the descendants of Canaan, who was the son of Ham, who was the son of Noah. And they were divided up into peoples, although you may take these all here different names this time, because some of them were particularly named Canaanites, but actually, in a broader sense, all of these peoples were called Canaanites at times. Are the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. I should put them as different ones, that is six. Or if they're all Canaanites, and they may be divided into the five sections. And most people take the latter as being the truth. Well, now that's a kind of a fierce-sounding statement there. Take them into a land where all of these peoples are noted for their strength and their cruelty and being hard to overcome and so on. And Moses is told that, by God, that he's going to take them into this land of the Canaanites. And then he repeats, now therefore behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come unto me. And I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Now, when we studied about the birth of Moses, and they saw that this was a proper child, no doubt his parents, Amram and Jochebed, knew that he was the proper child, one, and so did as they did according to faith. And no doubt Moses knew about it. But here is the first time that he gets his commission from God. And it was put out pretty quickly and bluntly. I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Doesn't give any details. He does a little bit later on, but doesn't tell Moses all the things going to happen. Just tell him to send him to Pharaoh. He doesn't go to tell him right away all of the difficulties he's going to have with that old fellow. And Moses said unto God, well, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Or that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? 40 years before this, Moses had been very bold about slaying an Egyptian, and probably the idea of getting his people to win the insurrection, deliver them out of Egypt. And of course, that's the style nowadays. If you're not satisfied with the government and so on, why, have a coup, overthrow the government, so on. Now, Moses isn't to do it that way. God said to Moses, "Certainly I will be with thee, and there shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain, Mount Horeb, Sinai." That's a promise. And they did, didn't they? And Moses said unto God, "Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of our fathers has sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them?" Well, wouldn't that title be enough? The God of our fathers? The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob? Do you remember that when we were studying about Jacob, speaking about the God of his father Isaac? Using no name. Of course, they knew the name Elohim, but that's a name which is plural, and the heathen use it, or their gods. And it is translated gods in Genesis. When Satan, in Genesis 3, when Satan said, "Ye shall be as gods," it was Elohim, like in the first verse of chapter 1. God, plural. And Moses said, "Well, how am I going to say who sent me?" And all that sort of thing. And Moses is going to be sure this time. He wasn't talking about being sent that first time. He slew the Egyptian and meddled in with his brethren. And God said unto Moses, "I am that I am." Well, that might not be too good at translation and so on, yet it's exactly what it means. I am is enough. I am is timeless. I am in the past, I am now, and I am in the future. The Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. We have all these titles back in the book of Revelation. That's the I Am. This is the one that Moses is speaking to, the one that he meets at the burning bush. And he said, "Thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, I am, and sent me unto you." And you remember that night in Gethsemane, that he said, "I am," and the soldiers fell back, fell down. And how many times in his ministry he said, "I am," the same one that met Moses here at the burning bush in the wilderness. And God said, "Moreover unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel." And so he told this message to give to the children of Israel. "The God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, have sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations." "Go and gather the elders of Israel together, and say unto them, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you, and seen that which is done of you to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the afflictions of Egypt unto the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. And they shall hearken to thy voice, and thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel, unto the king of Egypt, and ye shall say unto him, The Lord God of the Hebrews hath met with us. Now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Now, what would they have done if the king had allowed them to go out into the wilderness? You'll find later on they wanted to take everything with them. Their wives, their children, their flocks, and all their belongings. Now, if they'd have gone 3 days out into the wilderness, what would they have done? What were they planning to do in their hearts, at least? Well, they weren't ready for that. 3 million slaves, approximately that, to go out unorganized into the wilderness, well, probably wouldn't turn out too good for them. And Moses yet wasn't yet their leader and hadn't gotten them organized. And I am sure the king of Egypt will not let you go. No, not by a mighty hand. And I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. That is, the Israelites will have favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall come to pass that when you do go, or you go, ye shall not go empty. Empty-handed, we would say. But every woman shall ask. It's not borrow. They didn't borrow and then run off with it. They ask and is given to them willingly. It's very unfortunate the translators put that word in there like that. I know it's common among us American people to borrow something and forget to return it. Like, for instance, lending books. Well, we have bookkeepers. People who keep books and they borrow them. And all that sort of thing. You know about it. Borrowing tools and whatnot. Forget to return them. Or if they do, they're in an unusable condition. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, and of her that sojourneth in her house, that is, any servants and so on, jewels of silver, jewels of gold, and raiment, that is, clothing, and ye shall put them upon your sons and upon your daughters, and ye shall spoil the Egyptians. All this is in anticipation. All of it carried out practically to the letter. So now we have here, this chapter 3 is quite a preparation. I want you to notice that Moses said, who am I? Going to have trouble with this again as we go on, next chapter. And Moses was fearful in coming to the children of Israel and announcing his work he had to have. And so he had to have some credentials, as we say. Now, God didn't give him a brass badge to put on or something like that, or a gold star to put on and show him, but he did give him credentials that he could prove to these people something about his nation and so on. Well, the next time, let us begin with Exodus 4. We're going to get into some very interesting story here, so stay with us. All right, here we go again. Now, we've been studying the Epistle of Paul to the Galatians. And we got over in the 4th chapter, about the 7th verse. Now I have here a book, which I've had several years. It is, this one book here, a fairly good sized book, is just a study on Galatians. The date of it's about 1865. The author of the book is a man by the name of Whitefoot. I think his initials is on here somewhere. No, we don't have the initial even. Now, this Lightfoot is not the one that